This is Christine King in conversation with Professor Keith J. Laidler at the University of Ottawa on the 13th of October, 1983. Professor Laidler has worked on chemical kinetics in three countries, first in England at Oxford with Hinshelwood, then as a graduate student with Henry Eyring at Princeton in the United States, and with E.W.R. Stacey between 40 and 42 here in Canada. And this is largely the order in which our conversation will take place. So, Professor Laidler, let me begin by asking, you were born in Liverpool, England, in 1916. Were either of your parents particularly interested in science?
No, they weren't particularly interested in science, but they were interested in scholarly matters. They were both teachers. My father was a teacher throughout his career and ended up as a headmaster of a very large school. My mother was a teacher before she was married and necessarily in those days had to retire when she got married, but became a teacher again. So they were people who were interested certainly in teaching and in the general in learning in general, things of learning, but there was no particular interest in science on the part of my parents. They were more on the arts side, in fact.
Hmm. What about your school days? Tell us a little bit about your school days and any special teacher that influenced you.
Well, I had a fairly conventional education in England, and when I was about 14 or 15, I began to realize that I was very interested in science and mathematics more than in any other subjects, although I didn't do too badly in English and history and so forth, but I was clearly better at science. The school had a long tradition in classics and in history, and in fact my headmaster was a very distinguished classicist, was very surprised when I told him at one stage that I intended to become a scientist, because this was something he didn't really quite understand. He urged me to change my mind and go in for history. He realized I wouldn't do any good at classics, but he tried to get me to go into history. But I was firm, and he was extremely nice about it, I must say, and supported me very strongly for many years afterwards. But it was a surprise to him, and simply because he thought that there was no future in science. It happened that there were two teachers in the school, one who taught physics and one who taught chemistry, who were both very inspiring teachers, and this was a very great help to me, and they encouraged me to continue with my work with my interest in science. I had difficulty deciding whether to be a physicist or a chemist. It's hard to know now why I decided to become a chemist and not a physicist. But at any rate, I think it didn't make very much difference in the end. But I know it was a bit of a struggle for me at the time to decide, because I liked both of them almost equally well and was, I think, equally good at both of them. I might also mention that I had a magnificent mathematics master at school who really was also a most inspiring teacher, and his work contributed very much to my interest in physics and chemistry.
Well, you've answered my next one and a half questions, but one thing I wanted to ask you was, we know that the attitude towards the role of science has changed a great deal in England between the beginning of the 20th century and, say, 30 years later. What are your recollections of the place of science in English education as a whole when you began your serious interest in science?
Well, certainly when I was at school, science was at something of a low ebb, I think, in the schools. I think in the universities it was another matter, but I think the schools were a little behind the times. I think the schools in England did certainly tend to encourage people to go into the arts subjects, the classics and English and history and so on, and not to go so much into science. There were great exceptions to that, but there were some schools, I'm sure, that were exceptional in that respect. But I think the average school, both public and private school in England, tended to direct people towards the humanities rather than towards the sciences. And it was perhaps only individual students who decided themselves to go into science there. Of course, I'm thinking of the official policy of the schools. Now, of course, there were some splendid teachers of physics and chemistry in the schools in those days, probably better than now, because in those days that there wasn't so much industry, and therefore lots of first-rate graduates from universities, graduates in physics and chemistry, necessarily had to become school teachers, because unless they became professors, there wasn't much else for them to do. Nowadays, of course, there are so many jobs outside the teaching professions for graduates in physics and chemistry. But then, certainly, the teaching of physics and chemistry was considered a very honorable pursuit. Some very superior people did go into teaching of physics and chemistry. There was no biology taught in my school at all. It was just never mentioned. But physics and chemistry were certainly taught very well. And naturally, of course, the teachers that I had, and doubtless the teachers that many other people had, were very much interested in encouraging their students to go into the sciences.
I suppose this is a bit of a difficult question, but can you still remember the kind of chemistry and physics you were taught? Were you introduced to very recent or current topics by your teachers?
I can tell perhaps a little story that will illustrate that point. I believe I was very lucky, but I was, I think, introduced to a number of very recent concepts in science by these two masters who were exceptionally good. I remember when I first went to Oxford and talked to Hinshelwood, he recommended to me that I should get Sidgwick's Electronic Theory of Valency and read it. And I said to him, well, I have already read that. I read it at school. And he was most surprised, very impressed, and said, really, really? He said, are the schools really teaching that now? Now, that, I think, was perhaps unusual, because Sidgwick's book had only just come out. But my chemistry master was a great admirer of Sidgwick. He was an Oxford graduate himself, and he remembered Sidgwick very well, a great admirer of Sidgwick, and he was very impressed by this famous book, The Electronic Theory of Valency. So he did have me read it as a schoolboy. Mm-hmm. But I think perhaps that's a little exceptional.
Mm-hmm. What about in physics?
In physics, similarly, I think we were introduced to quite modern concepts in physics. So that certainly when I became an undergraduate, I felt I had a good background. Of course, one has to remember that things like quantum mechanics in 1934, when I left school, not too much was understood about quantum mechanics. And in fact, even when I was an undergraduate, I took one course in quantum mechanics, which was really very good. I learned my quantum mechanics actually after I went to Princeton in 1938.
Just for the record, perhaps we should note the name of your master's.
Oh yes. Well, I should have mentioned them. One was Mr. C.T. Parton, who taught physics, and the other was Mr. Dickinson, D-I-C-K-I-N-S-O-N. He always insisted that he wasn't in any way connected with Charles Dickens, who taught chemistry, and Mr. Prestwick, who taught mathematics. Mr. Prestwick.
Did you have any clear objectives between leaving school and going to Oxford? Were you very decidedly on the science side?
Oh yes, very definitely by that time, in fact before that, because the system that I was brought up on was that there was a sixth form in the school where we specialise very considerably. This, of course, is not so today, but there was considerable specialisation in school, so that when I went into the sixth form, which I did at the age of 15, I took from then on nothing but physics, chemistry, mathematics, English and divinity, which was compulsory for everyone. And then the examinations that I took at the end of those years were Oxford and Cambridge school certificate examinations, as they were called, in those subjects, including divinity. We had to do that, and English also was required for everyone. But after the age of 15, I had no teaching in history or geography or of course classics. I had a certain amount of Latin. Of course, Latin in any case was required for admission to Oxford in those days, so I had to have enough Latin to get into Oxford, but I had that by the time I was 15. I had a little Greek, but very little, and I've forgotten all of it. But for the last 3 years, I was 3 years in the sixth form. The first year I was taking at the end of all of those 3 years, if I remember, I took higher school certificate examinations, but in the later years I took them as a higher level papers, and I took them, as I say, in chemistry, physics, mathematics and English, and I think there was a paper in divinity each year. I'm not quite sure of that, but certainly there was the first 2 years.
What about modern languages?
Modern languages, we'd had a lot of that again before I got into the sixth form. I had a very good French teacher who taught us French grammar extremely well, and so that I was able to read and write French. Unfortunately, as I discovered years afterwards when I talked to this particular master, he himself couldn't really speak French. He couldn't conduct a conversation in French at all, although he had a good accent. He would have managed, of course, in France, but he wasn't at all fluent in French. And I think this was rather unfortunate. We did learn the French in a very academic way. German again, I can't remember exactly how I learned German, but I did have to take some lessons in German at school. I think they were on the side, because German in my time was required for a degree at Oxford in science, and so I knew, looking ahead, I knew that I was going to have to take an examination in German, so I did take some German at school.
So when you went up to Oxford to do science, you were expected already to be able to read scientific papers in both French and German?
That's right, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. One had to satisfy the examiners at the very beginning of one's undergraduate career in those days. I'm not sure that what's so now, but in those days one had to satisfy the examiners at the beginning of one's undergraduate career that one could read French and German adequately. Mm-hmm.
You went up to Oxford on an open scholarship in 1934. I'd like to know what your first impressions were, but before that I wanted to ask, what was the pull towards Oxford as opposed to, say, Cambridge or other major school of science in England? Was there any influence from?
Yes, I think it was Mr. Dickinson who perhaps had a slightly stronger influence on me than Mr. Parton. Mr. Dickinson was a chemistry master, Mr. Parton was a physics master. Mr. Dickinson, I think, had a slightly stronger influence, although I admired both of them very much. I got to know Mr. Parton extremely well later. He died only rather recently, as a matter of fact, and I kept in touch with him, and he was a very fine person. Mr. Dickinson was perhaps a more volatile person, a little more persuasive, and as a young man I was, I think, persuaded more by him because of his personality. He was a great enthusiast himself for Oxford. He was an Oxford graduate himself. He went to Oriel College. He went to Corpus Christi College, He was always telling me about the glories of Oxford and how splendid Oxford was for chemistry. Now this was true, of course, and it was he who told me all about the work of Sidgwick on the one hand and Hinshelwood on the other. Sidgwick he knew well when he was an undergraduate. Hinshelwood, who of course was much younger, Hinshelwood was I think 39 when I became an undergraduate, so that when this man was an undergraduate, Hinshelwood was probably only in his 20s, but he knew of him as a great man, one who was going to make great advances in chemistry. And I remember him telling me that at school that much was going to come from Hinshelwood, and of course he was absolutely right. And I think perhaps it was some of these personal matters that inspired me. Now, Mr. Parton, he talked about, he was a Cambridge man. A physicist, he talked mildly about Cambridge, because perhaps of his quieter personality, he didn't particularly inspire me to go to Cambridge. So I think it was really as simple as that.
Yeah, that's interesting. So coming back to your first impressions.
My first impressions when I became an undergraduate.
Yes, when you first went up to Oxford.
Yes. Of course, I was impressed by the people I came in touch with. Hinshelwood, in particular, who was always extremely nice, extremely pleasant as a tutor. It was always well known that he was an extremely kindly tutor. He wasn't perhaps as kindly towards people with whom he had other kinds of relationships. He was considered to be a very difficult man by many of his colleagues and so on, and became more so in later life. But I must say for him that he was always extremely courteous and helpful towards his students. I never heard any complaint of any kind.
Well, I was hoping to come on to Cyril Hinshelwood a little bit later, because I think it would be nice to talk about him in some detail. Going back to your earlier impressions, I believe, in fact, your first choice was not the college where Trinity,
yes,
where you ended up.
Yes.
How did this come about?
Mr. Dickinson actually recommended that I should take a scholarship in a group of colleges that included Lincoln College and Trinity College. Now, the tutor at Lincoln was Sidgwick, and the tutor at Trinity was Hinshelwood. And on his recommendation, I put Sidgwick down as first choice, that is, Lincoln College down as first choice, and Trinity as second choice. There's a certain amount of sorting out in these. I took a scholarship examination, in other words, that covered those two colleges plus a number of others, including Balliol and Christchurch, I think, and several others. But anyhow, that doesn't matter. And of course, the examiners get together and they look at the papers and they sort it all out. And Hinshelwood apparently saw something good in what I had written. And he said he'd like to have me, and Sidgwick didn't quarrel with that, so that's the way it worked out.
Before we start talking about your work with Hinshelwood, it would be nice if you told us a little bit about other teachers.
Yes.
First of all, were there any strange rules that you remember from your Oxford days, your undergraduate term?
Of course, when one went to Oxford in those days, and to some extent now, of course, one had to learn that there were certain conventions that had to be followed. Some of them that may seem rather absurd, but we had to wear gowns under certain circumstances, of course. Certainly when we had dinner in hall, we had to wear gowns when we saw fellows of the college. There was an exception to that, because my colleague for the same year, Hobbs, who also was a scholar of Trinity in chemistry the same year, he and I had joint tutorials. Hinshelwood taught the two of us together, and so we both dutifully appeared at Hinchinwood's, in Hinchinwood's room wearing our gowns, and Hinchinwood raised his eyebrows and said, "Oh, don't bother with those things," and so we didn't wear them from then on. But that was his style. He didn't care. He didn't mind about that. But of course, one had to do it. Even if one knew that, one had to do it the first time and have him suggest that we should not bother from then on. Seeing when one went to see any other fellow, like as a junior dean or anybody of that kind, one would be required to wear one's gown. And then, of course, there were certain restrictions about coming in and going out of the college gates. The college gates were closed at midnight, and this one climbed over the wall, which at Trinity was a bit difficult. One couldn't get in after midnight, and then there was serious trouble because the president of the college was rather a stern old gentleman, and it would have been more than one's career was worth to get into trouble of that kind. So one was always dutiful about being in by midnight. Another curious thing was that one couldn't go out of the college after, I think, 10 o'clock. I don't know quite why there was that rule, but if you wanted to go out in the evening, you had to be out before 10. I think it was 10, it may have been 9, but I think it was 10. So that one had to contrive to be out before 10 if one wanted to go out at all. A curious rule, I don't know what the reason for it was. Apart from that, I don't think there were many difficulties. It was a free and easy life in many ways. It was very pleasant, very happy existence. One got to know people very quickly. I knew quite a few people from my own school, but I quickly got to know other people. I never had any problems at all as an undergraduate. Enjoyed it very much.
What did you do during the long vacations?
Well, of course, the joke at Oxford is that one does all one's work in the vacations and doesn't do much in term time, and there are people who don't do very much either in term time or during vacation. But I was fairly conscientious, and so I did in fact do work during vacation. This was prescribed by tutors. Hinchinwood, I remember, I never forget my surprise when at the end of my first term, that is before Christmas 1934, Hinchinwood in the last tutorial said, "Oh well, I must give you some work to do over the vacation. Just read Sommerfeld's Atom, Bau and Spectralinium." I was slightly taken aback by this, because this book, which had only recently come out, had not been translated, so it was a question of reading it in German, and it was a fairly high-powered text. So it was a bit of a struggle to get through that book, which was fairly good size, if I remember. And then at the end, when we came back after the vacation, we had a little examination on it, on what we had learnt from Sommerfeld's book. That was the usual pattern, certainly with Hinchinwood. At the end of each term, he would assign some reading and then give an examination on it at the beginning of the following term. Now, the one thing I should mention that's a little amusing was that we dutifully wrote the examination, and Hinchinwood never, on any occasion, ever made any reference to that examination. Whether we were to conclude that we had done it satisfactorily, or that he was disgusted at how little we did, I don't know, but the fact is he never said anything. I assume that, of course, he was fairly satisfied that we'd done something about it at any rate. Now, there was another undergraduate of my year who never did a stroke of work, and he got along with Hinchinwood quite well. He also took these examinations and presumably did very badly, and he had the same treatment. Hinchinwood never said anything. So it's all right. Undoubtedly, Hinchinwood had it in his mind, remembered all this, as though when it came to writing recommendations later on, he made some distinction between this other person who did no work and ourselves. But that was Hinchinwood's style. But now, some tutors, I gathered, were more I won't say more conscientious, but were at least did mark the examinations and did discuss the results with the students. Hinshaw didn't. For all I know, he didn't read them.
Tell us a little more about how the teaching was actually carried out at Oxford.
Yes, well, lectures were not compulsory, nor were laboratories, amazingly enough. And for many years that continued. I'm not sure whether they are now compulsory, but neither lectures nor laboratories were compulsory. The procedure was that there was a schedule of lectures, of course, that the tutors had and that we saw, and Hinshaw would, at the beginning of each year, would say, well, so-and-so is giving lectures on such-and-such, I think you should take them. Or sometimes he would say, so-and-so is giving lectures and I don't think they'd be worth your while going, it wouldn't be worth your while going to them. I can remember he was doing that on one or two occasions. And we dutifully went to the lectures that Hinshaw had recommended, which didn't amount to very many. They were all given in the mornings. In the afternoons, the laboratories were open, and so people tried to go, these conscientious students, went to laboratories in the afternoon from, let's say, 2 to 5 or something of that kind, and worked on experiments. There were cards in the laboratory, and you picked out a card for the experiment you wanted to do, and you did it. And people who were called demonstrators were actually very distinguished people in many cases, like R.P. Bell and so on. They would wander around, and if they saw you in any trouble, they'd ask if they could help. But if they thought you were happy, they would ignore you. So that you could go for days and days without anyone saying anything. Sometimes they'd just stop to chat, to discuss the experiment, or even discuss other things. So it was all very, really very informal. They obviously made sure people didn't do anything dangerous, but we were very much left to ourselves on that. Now, one might wonder, well, why did one bother to go to lecture to laboratories if they were not compulsory? The catch was that in the examination system at Oxford, there was a practical examination which was quite demanding. So that if one had not gone through a lot of the experiments, one would have considerable difficulty with the practical examination. So one might fail to get a degree or fail to get a good degree. Now, another point was that the laboratories did report to the tutors on the presence or absence of the students, so that Hinshaw knew what laboratories we had gone to and so on, how many times we'd been. And in the case of Holmes and myself, I'm saying we because we tended to work together throughout my undergraduate career, because we were rather similar in background and so on. Hinshaw never actually said anything to us because we were both fairly conscientious. Now, a person who neglected his laboratory work might get a reprimand from his tutor and told he'd better do better next term.
So if you conscientiously worked through these cards given to you in the lab sessions, you could be sure to pass the exam at the end?
Well, not sure, of course, but one could be reasonably confident if one had understood the experiments and had done them and had gained the necessary skills from going through the experiments. One could be reasonably confident. If one did not, it would be very, very difficult to pass the practical examination because of the nature of the examination. The examination did require some technical skill, of course, and knowledge of how to set up the experiment.
Could you elaborate a little bit about your other lectures when you were an undergraduate at Oxford?
Yes.
Who do you remember?
Yes, well, R.P. Bell, of course, stands out as a very good lecturer. He lectured on solutions and acids and bases and so on, and to some extent acid-base catalysis, the theory of solutions, thermodynamics of solutions. And he was extremely good. Wolfenden, who is now at Dartmouth College in the States, he lectured on electrochemistry. He was the electrochemistry at the time, and then of course it was Bowen, E.J. Bowen, on photochemistry. There was Ogston, A.G. Ogston, who later became a physiologist and later in fact became president of my college, Trinity. He was professor of biochemistry in Australia later in life, but then he was a young Don who also taught solution theory at that time, thermodynamics of solutions. Now that's in physical chemistry. Now I should mention, of course, the other fields. Sidgwick, of course, stands out as a magnificent lecturer. In my second year, I believe it was my second year, I attended his lectures on inorganic chemistry. He was then writing his book, his famous book on inorganic chemistry, and he was lecturing from the manuscript, obviously, but it was a superb set of lectures, so beautifully organized and covering the field in such a comprehensive way. He's the inorganic lecturer who really stands out as quite extraordinary. Now, organic chemistry, Sir Robert Robinson, who was then working on the structure of strychnine, if I remember, and he gave. I attended two separate courses of lectures that he gave. One was concerned with basic organic techniques and so on, and then he went on to describe his own work on structural strychnine. Of course, this in those days was all done by classical organic methods. There were no spectrophotometers, at least there weren't many that were available, and all the modern techniques, of course, were then not available. So it was all done by classical organic techniques, and the work was done in the most laborious way, but it was really a great education to see how that kind of analysis was done, how the structure of a complicated molecule was determined by those classical methods. And then also he gave a course of lectures on the electronic theories of chemical reactions. Of course, I was particularly interested in that because that was very much related to kinetics, but he at that time had developed these electronic theories, inductive electromagnetic effects, somewhat similar to Ingalls' theories. Ingalls' theories are much better known today, I think, but Robinson had done very much the same things at roughly the same time. So those are the ones that stand. Now I did take a course from Soddy, Professor Soddy, in my first year. It was a course on radioactivity. Soddy was the professor of physical and inorganic chemistry at the time, and he was, as is well known now, a bit of a disappointment to Oxford. He'd been appointed as professor at a time when. Shortly after he'd done very famous work, he had quarrelled with the university authorities, and he was a rather disgruntled, unhappy man. He wasn't really doing very much chemistry at that time, but he did conscientiously give a course on radioactivity, which I remember as being perfectly adequate, not very inspiring. He wasn't an inspiring person, but it was perfectly adequately given, and I remember that very clearly, that series of lectures. I remember lectures from D.L. Chapman on the halogens, but that was a bit disappointing because it was really more on the inorganic chemistry of the halogens, which wasn't his field. I don't know why he was teaching that, It would have been more interesting if he talked about his kinetic work on the hydrogen-chlorine reaction, but there wasn't much of that. It was more about the regular inorganic chemistry of the halogens, which I didn't find particularly exciting, and which I don't think he did particularly well, perhaps because he didn't find exciting either.
Do you remember your interest already beginning to focus on one of the three major chemical topics?
Yes, I think that because I had this difficulty at school in deciding whether to be a physicist or a physical chemist, I had no difficulty in deciding that if I was going to be a chemist, it was going to be a physical chemist. I wanted to be on the physical side of things, and I think if I'd become a physicist, it probably would have been as a chemical physicist. In other words, I was interested really in the field that lies between physics and chemistry. So there was no difficulty about that, and I think for that reason, I think perhaps it was a blessing in disguise that I went to work with Hinshelwood and not with Sedgwick, because Sedgwick, of course, was a great man, indeed, but he was not really a physical chemist, although he'd done good kinetics. He did good kinetics in his early days, but his interest was really in inorganic chemistry, and I don't think I would have found that particularly inspiring. It's hard to judge, but I think I would not have found work in inorganic chemistry as inspiring as work in kinetics. And so, of course, when I found myself with Hinshelwood as a tutor, who clearly emphasized the physical side of chemistry, and certainly emphasized kinetics, then of course I went along with him. I might add, however, that Hinshelwood as a tutor was remarkably well rounded, because he did in fact tutor us in inorganic and organic chemistry. But I should say, perhaps by way of explanation, I should say his tutoring consisted of the rather old-fashioned method of having us write essays and reading them to him. He would assign an essay on a particular topic at the end of each tutorial, and we would work on it for a week and read him the essay. And I remember, for example, writing one on the anthocyanins, which certainly was far from Hinshelwood's own interests, but he felt that that was something that had to be covered in the tutorial. And we read it to him. He presumably learned something from what we said. I don't recall that he commented very much on the essay. But on the other hand, if we wrote him an essay on kinetics, of course he would be apt to get into an interesting discussion of it afterwards.
Well, I really wanted to ask you to talk a little bit now about Sir Cyril Hinshelwood, but you've already indicated quite a lot. I realize that since you have been involved with kinetics during most of your career, you probably came to know Hinshelwood a lot better later, after your student days. So we could talk about Hinshelwood as a personality at this stage, if you like, and perhaps ignore the chronology.
Yes. Right. Do you want to... Because it's not quite so that I knew Hinshelwood well in his later career, because I left England in 1938, and I was at Princeton, of course, until 40. It was in Canada during the war, with sometime in England also during the war, but I didn't see much of Hinshelwood at that time. I did, of course, whenever I visited England later on, I always went to see Hinshelwood, and he has been here in Ottawa, and I've seen him here. But I can't say, of course, that I knew him personally very much after my undergraduate days. I only knew him just for occasional meetings, perhaps only a dozen or so in all. Of course, I kept in touch with him. I wrote to him from time to time, and he was always very good about replying. He always replied immediately to any letter I wrote to him. But my knowledge of Hinshelwood in his later life derives, perhaps, is more second-hand, in the sense that I I, of course, know many people who knew him well, and so I have some feeling for his personality, and of course I've read most of his papers, I'm sure, so I know a lot about his work. I know about his later personality from discussions with people who knew him well, but I can't really say that I know that of my own knowledge.
Hinshelwood had some unusual interests, other interests.
Oh, yes.
A linguist and
yes.
A classicist.
Yes. Yes, he was very he was always very proficient at various languages. When I was undergraduate, we were aware of that fact. He seemed to be he could read several languages, and surprisingly enough, although he didn't travel a great deal, he did seem to pick up pronunciation of languages very well. And I mentioned that when some years, a year or two, not so long before his death, when he, this university, the University of Ottawa, gave him an honorary degree, Hinshelwood gave his speech of acceptance in French, and my French-speaking colleagues here were amazed with the quality of the French and the accent, and said that if they had not known, they would have thought he was a Frenchman. And yet, I don't believe he spent much time in France. I had heard, I think, that he did use the Berlitz records, and perhaps he could mimic an accent fairly well, so that he seemed to be able to pick up a very good French accent in some way. And I've heard the same about German. He spoke German quite fluently, and I believe with a very good accent. He could manage Chinese, I believe, but I was told that wasn't perhaps too fluent. Italian, I understand, was very good, and Russian, I believe in Russian he was competent. He didn't know much Greek, I believe, but his education background was probably somewhat similar to my own, in that he had to learn Latin and was quite good at Latin, but he didn't have much Greek. Although now that I think of it, when he went to Oxford, I think Greek was compulsory for admission. I think it probably was in those days. But I don't think he knew an awful lot of Greek. But this was, of course, of great use to him in his activities as president of the Royal Society and so on, because he was able to greet foreign visitors very fluently in their own languages.
Well, we might come back to Hinshelwood a little bit later in connection with kinetics in the 30s. Just coming back to the end of your training at Oxford, the final year of undergraduate studies is a crucial time when students have to decide on an area of specialization. How did you choose yours? Was there a special decision, a distinct?
Yes, well, the system at Oxford was that after 3 years one takes the examination for the Bachelor of Arts degree. One gets a BA degree at the end of 3 years. I'm speaking of a course in chemistry, of course. So at the end of 3 years, having gone to lectures and tutorials and so on for that period of time, one takes the final examinations, part one, as it's called, and then they mark the examinations, they give one a degree, but they don't give one the class of the degree. In other words, they don't say how well one has done. To obtain a class, one has to do what is called part two, which consists of research with someone. Now, normally one works with one's tutor, and in my case there was no question about that. I continued to work with Hinshelwood. I did my research, in other words, with Hinshelwood under his direction, and submitted a thesis at the end of the fourth year. And of course that was on a problem assigned by Hinshelwood, with a discussion with us as to what kinds of work we wanted to do. He had me do reactions in solution, and my colleague Hobbs did reactions in the gas phase.